Welcome to the Hobcast Book Show, a weekly podcast from Hobeck Books, an independent publisher of thrillers, crime, mystery, and suspense novels. Each week, we'll take you behind the scenes of what we do, the challenges and the triumphs, the bumps and troughs of running a creative business in this challenging world. We'll hear from the people who make this possible, the authors, the cover designers and editors, and we'll have expert insights from our guest star interviews. Nothing is off the agenda on the Hobcast Book Show from Hobeck Books, as we combine trad values and an indie spirit. And now it's time for our weekly trip to Staffordshire. And Adrian and Rebecca have a big conundrum to face in The Hobeckers.
Another one of those tractors coming past. You'd think they'd give it a rest at the weekends, wouldn't you?
Hi, love, you're back.
Yes, I am, Rebecca. Yeah, it's been a long day in the garden.
Well, I've been working on the figures and, my head is splitting.
I'm glad you're doing them, not me. Anyway, I guess you've been doing some prep as well for this week's Hobcast.
I have been doing some prep. It's episode 117.
Can't believe it. It seems to have flown by, though, hasn't it? We're doing it for over 2 years. Can you imagine?
Gosh, and that's because we're publishers of crime.
Mysteries.
Suspense.
And the other one. Thrillers.
Let's have a cuppa.
Oh, gosh, you've read my mind.
Put the kettle on. It's been a tough morning.
It's been a tough morning. Do you know what? It's just struck me. I've forgotten to tell the authors.
You haven't. Gosh, you better get onto it now.
Yeah, it's time we told them that we have a 24th author on our list.
We do. They need to know this.
Yeah. Well, I'm very excited by this one.
Me Hilly too, Barbie. Adrian.
Yeah, she's fantastic, Rebecca. Really good. And you'll have to remind me what the title of her book is.
Best served cold, sounds like your good dinner if we don't get a wriggle on.
Yeah. That's another one of our international contingent based in Spain. Gosh, do you know what? We could have a really good holiday. In fact, a great honeymoon if we went to visit all the authors around the world that we know.
I need a holiday. I don't know about you, Adrian.
Yeah, I know. It's tough at times, isn't it? And it doesn't get any easier out there. The cows will be out for milking soon. And yeah, it's a tough one.
I think we deserve a pint down the bull, don't you?
Yeah, the bull or the navigation even. That's a bit nearer.
True.
Yeah, but the beer's not very good. It's going to be a busy week this week. We might go to London. I don't like going up to London. You know, it's so, everything's so fast-paced.
Oh, I know what you mean, Adrian. It's so busy down there, isn't it? People everywhere. All we see is cows day in, day out.
Yeah, well, you know, we need to consider it because, you know, it's London Book Fair. And, you know what Reg gets like if you don't go to London Book Fair. Gets a bit twitchy.
If you do go down to London Book Fair, I think you should go and see our friends Joffy Books, because they need a congratulations.
Again, well, you know, their ever-expanding empire. It's hard to keep up sometimes. They've just bought another publisher.
Have they really, Adrian?
Yes, they have. And it's not a small one. It's Loom Publishing, which brings them another 800 authors.
That's amazing. Clary did say something about that in the cafe.
I'm sure it's the talk of the village. You know, that makes them the biggest independent publisher in the UK, or so they say, with 40 million books read. I don't know what they're doing or we're not.
Well, we do have two of their books.
We do. Sitting on the shelf right now.
What would Brian say?
Well, indeed. I'll tell you what, it's going to be causing a bit of a kerfuffle amongst the authors. And that is going to affect Uncle Bob.
Uncle Bob? Oh, gosh, what is it? You have to tell me.
Well, I hate to say it.
I need this cup of tea.
Yeah, why don't you go and pour it?
Yes, because I can't have bad news without a cup of tea.
No, and or indeed probably a gin for this particular character. Uncle Bob, Robert Dawes, is, of course, around the country. In fact, he's in Yorkshire at the moment, performing his one-man show, Woodhouse in Wonderland.
Woodhouse in Wonderland.
But Jeeves and Wooster books are being changed. Can you imagine? Oh, you've made me one. I can't believe it. They're changing the prose. Penguin have decided that P.G. Woodhouse's books need the treatment that Agatha Christie's just had and Ian Fleming. Can you imagine?
Oh, gosh. No, Adrian, I can't. Tell me more.
That the thief believes that modern readers will find the themes and characters outdated.
That's outrageous.
Yes, and guess what? They've gone and got the sensitivity readers involved.
Oh, not the sensitivity readers. I knew it would be trouble if they got those involved.
Yeah, well, they're death to anything, really. You know, so they're stripping out all the things that may be outdated. I'm just trying to find... there's a racial term, apparently, in Right Ho, the 1934 novel, which describes one character as a minstrel of the old school.
Wow. Do you know, I think Joe Grundy has a copy of that.
Well, that'd be worth something one day. That's we haven't mentioned who's coming around for a quick cuppa later on and joining us on the podcast.
No, we haven't. So we ought to, oughtn't we?
We ought to. Yes.
It's Amma.
No, we're not talking about next week's guest.
I do apologise, Adrian. My head is all over the place because I've been worrying about the London Book Fair.
Yes, Helene Keast is joining us to talk about her career.
She is indeed.
Fantastic author, so we'll look forward to speaking to Helene. Should be here any minute. Oh, gosh, I see you've been cleaning too. There's no end to your efforts.
I've been so busy. The figures, cleaning.
It's always difficult here.
And all this worry.
Yeah.
Need a pint at the Navigation Inn.
Such is the life in a rural area like Norbury Junction. It doesn't get any tougher than this. Anyway, I'll tell you what. Oh, I think I can hear a knock on the door. That'll be Helene now. Let's go and speak to Helene Keast. Helene Keast, thanks so much for joining us here on the Hobcast Book Show.
It's my absolute pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
It's our pleasure to have you on board. And you're speaking to us from Scotland.
From Glasgow, my garden office, which is currently very cold because I refuse to keep the heating on past the 1st of April.
Well, you're like me. Yeah. We're having this battle at the moment, actually.
We are. Look, it's blowing a hoolie.
A blanket.
It's blowing a hoolie out there. And this barn, we're very exposed because there's a field just in front of us and there's nothing stopping the wind. When it blows, it just, the temperature drops glacially here. And I've just cranked the volume, the boiler up a little.
Yeah, but whereas in my head, that feels wrong. It's mid-April. That just feels wrong to be using heating. It's...
Yeah, I know. I have to
just turn a blind eye when I see him do that.
Anyway, welcome to you to the program from your garden office. And how do you come to be in Glasgow? What path of life has brought you to this point?
It's such a strange place to be for a Dutch woman. Well, the Scottish men are net importers of women. And I am one of them. I met my husband 25 years ago when we both joined the same company, me in Amsterdam and him in London. And we were sent on a 3-week training course in a hotel in Florida. So when you are in your late 20s and stuck in a hotel for 3 weeks with other people, stuff happens.
Yeah, I love that.
That's quite some stuff.
I mean, I knew you were Dutch, but I just suddenly thought, because I lived in Amsterdam for a year and I absolutely loved living in Amsterdam. It was a wonderful year as a student. And my best discovery, Dutch discovery, was something called dubbel vla.
Yeah. It's custard.
I know, but we didn't really have like the chocolate and the strawberry flavours as well. And the fact you could have the two together. I love that stuff.
Hopjes is a kind of, it's a sweet from The Hague. It's a little hard-boiled sweet that you suck on, and it's got a caramelly taste, and they make this custard with that flavour, and it's fantastic.
Wow.
Okay. Have you ever had vla?
No, I don't think I have.
Oh, well, we'll have to go sometime, and I'll get you some vla, double vla.
Blah, blah, blah. Sounds amazing. Right. Well, you know, I'm cutting back on sugar, so we can't do that. But
it's not that sweet.
So, anyway. I mean, that's fabulous. But I mean, in your biog on Amazon, you describe yourself as sort of a globe-trotting
you know, sort of career person.
Yeah.
And so how much of that experience of working around the world and traveling plays a part in your work?
Interestingly, not a huge amount, because I think, you know, when you're trying to write books, you try to write books for people who can relate to them a lot. And so they are set primarily in Scotland. I am a diplomat child, so I grew up all around the world. The fact that I was in Amsterdam for that job was actually a fluke, because I've not lived in the Netherlands all that much in grand total. And I went to a French school, and I learned my English when I was 10, but it's now my strongest language, because primarily because of the international career, I've worked in English mostly. So after studying in the Netherlands, I studied chemistry of all things. I went to work in Brussels for a company called Procter & Gamble. I used to make Fairy Liquid. So there are some mentions of Fairy Liquid in the books. And there are, and certainly in Stay Mad Sweetheart, which is a corporate thriller in a data science startup, that's very close to the sort of strategy consulting that I do now. But there's a lot of little details that nobody else would understand in the books, but they are firmly set in Scotland.
Right. Okay. And that's, I mean, you've been, how long have you been in Scotland now then? It's clearly home. Years. Sorry?
21, 22
years. Wow, okay. So this is the longest you've stayed anywhere.
So you spent your first half of your life going everywhere, all over the place and being everywhere, and then you've now settled. So that must feel quite different.
It can get a bit boring. You know, you get a little bit antsy and what's next? And I think that's the affliction that, you know, army kids have as well. On the one hand, there's something absolutely phenomenal about having a stable home. And on the other hand, you're like, but this is it. And it's really that feeling of, is this it, that got me into writing. I mean, it was a bit of a midlife crisis where you're like, but surely there's something else I could be doing from here.
You're traveling in your mind in a way, aren't you? It might not be a different place because they're set in Glasgow, but you're traveling to a different sort of reality that you've created. So I can see why that is.
Just to challenge yourself in different ways.
Yeah. So when did the midlife crisis strike you? When did you first put words to screen?
It's ongoing. I was 2017. Basically, I decided this year I'm going to write a book. And I told all my Facebook friends that I would do so on the 1st of January 2017 and committed to having something done by the end of the year, which I did. And I chose crime because I really like reading crime, and I wanted to have a nice, fast-paced, kind of short chapter type of novel. And so on the 23rd of December, I sent it off to an editorial assessment and a beta reader saying, right, that's me done, and you can tell me what you think of it on the 4th of January. And overnight, because my beta reader was in India, I got a bunch of emails from her saying, oh, this looks really nice. Oh, I started it. This, oh, my God. Oh, I finished. It's fabulous. And you're like, oh, okay.
Oh, wow. That is quick.
Unexpected. Because, you know, when I set out to write the book, it was really just for me. And, yeah, I was going to self-publish and my mom would buy it maybe or expect me to give her one. But I certainly didn't have any expectations to have an author career. Definitely not. But when the editor also came back and said, you got a cracking read here, I thought, oh, there's I can do this. This is nice.
Wow. And you got that endorsement as well. I mean, it garnered nominations for some major awards. I mean, for the Selfies at the London Book Fair, and Next Generation Indie Book Awards, that's for a latter book. But that, you know, Best European Fiction Silver Medal as well at the Independent Publishers Book Awards in the US, which is, that is phenomenal.
Yeah, so, I mean, very impressive. You know, we've got writers, or we know lots of writers, don't we? We know loads of writers.
But we do know
some have been writing for years and years and years, or they take 10 years to write their first book. And so that must have felt amazing to get that sort of...
It was. Again, it's just kind of... you know, I did it because I wanted to step out of the ordinary, and boy, you know, did that work? Because the reason I ended up self-publishing that one, aside from it being rejected by agents for not fitting a particular nice niche, you know, box for a genre, is that I had applied to be a Crime in the Spotlight writer for Bloody Scotland. So you said that, and I thought, okay, well, here's the thing, I'm going to submit to it, and if they accept me, then I'm going to have to self-publish because I'm going to have a book. And so that's what happened. And what was amazing is that I had convinced Sharon Berden, who's obviously a very well-respected crime blogger, to read it before then. And because of her endorsement, lots of other people followed. But she actually came to Bloody Scotland and came to say hi and stuff after my event and to say how much she was enjoying it. So yeah, it was quite whirlwind. And what it's done for me is just introduced me to so many fun and nice people. You know, it is now not a career, although, you know, you'd like it to be, but it's really a social thing for me now. It's opened up that whole world of very different people to the ones I tend to you know, deal with in my professional life.
Yeah, we found that as well, haven't we?
Yeah,
the cult crime writing community. It's not just the writers, but the readers, the bloggers, the reviewers, the or anyone who's involved in it. They just, it's such a big community spirit, isn't it?
It is, yeah, absolutely. But I think there's also this feeling that, you know, we've got to support each other, because goodness knows there's enough things out there to distract people from you know, to take their attention and indeed their purchasing power. So you know we're all sort of supporting each other, that we all, you know, as the tide rises, floats all boats, doesn't it? And that's really the sort of spirit in which I think everyone we've met in the industry has approaches it. I hope that's the case.
Yeah, I haven't heard that phrase before. I like that.
Oh, right.
The tide rises and it floats all the boats.
Yeah, something like that.
No, I'm certainly do my best to cheerlead, particularly on Twitter, and just support and just gush about other people and their creations. So definitely. And I've benefited from a lot of that as well.
Do you get people asking you for advice now that you're, you know, a little bit further in your writing career?
Yeah. And you should never ask me for advice or my opinion, because I'm a blunt Dutch woman. And you know, I had my editor, so I do have an editor named Sarah Cox, and she's very good. She has a friend who's written something, and she didn't want to give her an assessment of it because she's a friend. And she said, well, I could send it to Helene, but you have to really, really want to. And you have to drink some vodka before you read the feedback. because, you know, I'll tell it like it is.
But I think that's a good thing, because sometimes, you know, where you might send something to someone and they'll just say, yeah, it's great.
And I mean, I don't try to shatter anyone's dreams. Let me just quickly make that point. I will continue to encourage and support, and, you know, by no means say, oh, don't bother, because, you know, agents don't even reply nowadays. You know, you know, I will state the facts and give you the context in which to make your own decisions.
Mm.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, that first book, In Servitude, deals with Glasgow's, you know, crime gangland kind of background. So how much of that did you research? Do you know people from that?
No.
I mean, but, you know, it feels very evident when you're in bits of Glasgow, I have to say. It's one of the cities I love. And in fact, you know, all the best cities in the world have that undercurrent, I think.
Mm.
For Glasgow in particular, almost there's a subculture almost glorying in its violent reputation and the hardness of the people. And actually, they've got hearts of gold, most of them, but there are some really nasty people knocking around as well. So how much did you have to research that, or was that just sort of evident? And was it or was it work of your imagination on this?
Partly it's the reputation. So, you know, when I lived in Edinburgh first, before moving to Glasgow, and when we were, when we moved from my husband's job, and when we were going to go to, oh my God, Glasgow, ooh, you know, that's the West End, and so when I moved here in an area called Pollock Shields in Glasgow, south of the river, it is surrounded by very multicultural areas. It is very multicultural, and also just the closeness of the slightly more struggling areas with the more affluent. It's very close, and I think that's why I thought, well, what should I write about? It became very clear to me that what I needed to write about is, you know, how would someone like me, how would a well-to-do woman get embroiled with gangsters accidentally who are just on your doorstep? And, you know, we've all watched enough movies and all of that to get an idea of what they're like. But I did also use some of my work expertise in that it tackles money laundering, which as a strategy consultant, having done very many projects for financial institutions, every time I start a new project, they make me go through the money laundering training. So I was kind of sick of it. I was like, oh, well, we're going to do money laundering. At least it's got a use now.
Yeah, that's
interesting, isn't it? Yeah, because I wouldn't know anything about money laundering. I wouldn't have a clue.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, when I was at the BBC, we had to go through anti-money laundering, anti-bribery, all sorts of courses.
Yeah.
Then I would end up in countries hosting events where all of that was happening. And basically to get anything done, like in Nigeria, I basically had to bribe my way around.
To go to the toilet.
Yeah. I mean, it was as crazy as that, as spending $10 to go to the toilet in Lagos.
When you had a rather big issue.
Well, yeah. If you've eaten goat knuckle soup from a street shack, yeah, you're going to have trouble.
It's thousands then.
Yeah. It did. But no, I mean, it is something that I think society turns a blind eye to it. It feels like it's a victimless crime in some people's views. Mm. What's your take on it?
Well, it's not. It's obviously anything that provides more money to criminals will just fund more crime. And I sit on the board of a company that basically scours the internet for counterfeit goods and takes them down. And so I'm very concerned about the proceeds of crime. You know, if you're buying your fake mascara, you might not realize that you are contributing to human trafficking, you know, but you are. You're just thinking, hey, I got a cheap mascara. And the worst thing that could happen is, you know, I get a little irritated because it's not the real thing.
Mm.
Yeah. And, you know, with Glasgow, I mean, I remember this vividly back in the 90s when I used to visit a lot more than I have done recently, but going to the Barrows, which is I've mentioned it before on the podcast, but this is a market in the Barrowlands part of Glasgow, in the east of Glasgow, near Celtic Park, that kind of area. And it is full. It is the world's greatest counterfeit sort of marketplace ever, especially if you want software, or at least in those
what
days.
Software?
You know, like for computers.
Oh, I think you meant like clothes.
No. But it is an extraordinary place. And it is full of people's, you know, selling counterfeits.
I mean, you know, granny knickers that you see on those sort of markets. Not CDs, sorry.
Right. Yeah. Anyway, we'll get back to the subject of the Barrows. Anyway, I mean, you know, but it is very evident. You know,
yeah, and in many places, you know, you go to any tourist trap like Venice and Florence and all of that, and they'll have the fake Louis Vuitton bags out and the fake Gucci sunglasses and all of that. And I mean, the, you know, not to get too technical, the customs people do a huge amount of work to stop stuff coming into the UK. But you know, because everything's gone online so much, there's huge new opportunities. And actually, in wrong side this book, I'm so bad at getting this right, What I Hid From You, which is my latest novel, it's around a dentist who gets addicted to Valium, and when she can't prescribe it for herself anymore without attracting attention, she goes online and thinks that she's buying you know, from a genuine sort of pharmacist, only to find that it's the local drug dealers who then recognize her because she's local and blackmail her with this information to then deal through the clinic. So there are definitely victims of these crimes.
Yeah, this is what I hid from you is the book we're talking about, isn't it?
It's quite clever, isn't it? Because they're sort of the big crimes, but in this case, it's happening to a very ordinary person and almost not by accident exactly, but...
Well, I mean, you wouldn't expect it from a dentist. I'm a professional person, you know, with 7 years training behind them and all that sort of thing. But you say, when you were writing the book, that this is inspired, maybe not directly, but by the many dentists that you know.
Well, yeah, actually, if you so, yes, I have quite a few dentists. I have one in my family and a few around, you know, who are the parents at school. And we used to have breakfast and they would tell large tales of misdeeds by their colleagues. And also, if you just look at the General Dental Council's website, you can see some of the really quite scary things that some people have been embroiled in, and that, you know, there are also very many statistics about substance abuse among medical professionals and suicide, things like that. And so that's really the premise of What I Hid From You, where Radha is traumatized by the death of a patient in her chair, and she was given a Valium to calm down. But then realizes that, you know, not only does she get sort of PTSD and just anxiety through that, her life in general is quite full of pressure, you know, but professional pressure. She's a mom, she wants to be the perfect daughter, she cares for her dad, she wants to be the perfect wife, perfect everything, and the pressure at the school gates and absolutely everything. And so she just succumbs to this addiction, which is very easily done.
That's very true, isn't it?
Well, it, yeah, it is actually, though. I mean, I talking about medical professionals, I have a good friend who's the, what is he now? He's head of theatre nurses at one of the big hospitals in Manchester. And he used to joke that when they used to go out on a sort of work bender, getting drunk and all that sort of thing, they would all take turns on the oxygen. And when they got back in to the office the day, you know, into the ward or whatever, the day after, because that would, it was the best hangover cure they'd ever found, was to go same with pilots. Apparently they try and cover their tracks, you know, if they've had a few too many and they're supposed to be.
Well, nowadays they're a lot stricter on that, but I've got a friend who's a pilot, and when she started, they'd get completely wasted and then fly home the next
day. Yeah, anyway, I mean, we're sort of digressing really, but let's just turn to that character of Radha then. I mean, you have just distilled in that way you describe them, you know, as a character with, you've given them plenty to work with in terms of things that are going, you know, you put them in a few pickles there and a lot of the pressures. So is that something that you spend a lot of time thinking about, you know, when you're going to create a character like that, you put them through the ringer?
Well, it would be a boring book if you didn't.
Sure, no, for sure.
It's like, oh, she stubbed her toe, poor Radha. But I think, you know, part of, interestingly, all three books, so In Servitude as well as Stay Mad, Sweetheart, and What I Hid From You, talk about sort of the female experience in many ways. And in Stay Mad, Sweetheart, the female experience very much with the lens of sort of harassment and discrimination. But the other two are more domestic thrillers. And it is around some of the societal pressure that is on women, but also the pressure that they put on themselves. And the What I Hid From You, you know, she's doing some stupid things, right? And you should just ask for help, but we don't, right? We don't, because we think we can cope. We think we can handle it. We don't want to disappoint people. And so that's really a reflection very much of, you know, the average woman, particularly middle-aged woman's experience of being that sandwich generation. And that's really what I started with as a premise, and then had to find ways to entrap her in situations that she then needed to find ways to get out of that weren't, you know, that weren't obvious.
I think that's the attraction for the reader, because I love that sort of psychological domestic noir. because you, when you're reading it, you think, this could happen to me.
Yeah, I think that's crucial. That makes
it so gripping because it's, you know, it's not like a fantasy or, you know, like the sort of traditional thriller where they're running around with guns and drinking whiskey all over the world or whatever. But, you know, you read it, you think, gosh, that could be me. Or I feel like that.
Well, I read a thriller and I think that could be me, you know.
What, the running around with guns and the
But, I mean, that's the male fantasy, but actually what we're talking about here is the appeal for female readers towards stories that take them through their experiences and articulate them, but through story. Mm. Is that a fair way to describe it?
Absolutely. And then, you know, have a fun story of this could happen to you. I try to make my books very realistic. Also try not to be very black and white about things, and leave a couple of things open-ended, because otherwise it's too neat, and life isn't neat. Life is messy.
Yeah. Well, the question that popped into my head, I mean, as you were saying, you know, about the things that writing from a perspective of a character who's feeling the pressures that many women do, from sandwich generations, you described it. What's your feeling on this? Because, I mean, I don't know how Rada gets out of this situation, or indeed any of your characters resolve these things, but how much of that is self-imposed? How much of that is, you know, driven by society? Do your characters sort of finally come to their senses and sort of say, well, actually get their priorities straight and figure out what's important, as opposed to what they think people think should be important? If I'm not being too obscure.
I understand what you're saying. I think particularly Rada, but also in Servitude, it starts out very self-inflicted, right? And you want to... I have friends, and I know many women who will, you know, tell you the story of what's going on with them and this and that. And then sometimes you just want to slap them because you say, well, why are you doing this? And so in the book, you know, they have little examples to exemplify this. So going into the kitchen in the morning and rearranging the dishwasher because it hasn't been done properly. We've all done it, right?
No, I do that. That's me. I'm terrible at it.
And sort of, you know, somebody hasn't done the laundry. Well, I'll start the laundry. Well, but I'll only do these two things. And then you're at it. And it's, oh, okay, I'll just do this a little bit more. And, you know, there's so a lot of it is self-inflicted. And I do talk to my friends, you know, when they are showing these kind of traits, which I have recognized in myself and have tried to overcome. It's still hard. I'm still a control freak, but, you know, less than I used to be. And I think the thing to remember, you know, that sort of control freakery fits with a dentist's character. It fits with a personal trainer's character, which is also, you know, my first, in my first novel. And so these are genuine responses that I think many people have. I think it's partly societal because we wouldn't be putting the pressure on ourselves to be perfect, because there wouldn't be a perfect unless it was shown to us what perfect is. But at the same time, we do stupid things that really you should let go. And yeah. And you know, once you hit 50, like I did a few years ago, you really don't give a crap anymore.
Yay.
Yeah, is that right?
I'm 51. Yeah, I'm 51.
I don't remember. Yeah, your memory's gone. So that's the first thing that went.
Yeah. No, it's true. No,
at age 40, I started saying no more. And age 50, I just don't give a hoot anymore about anything. I'm just going to do it.
But how much of that is being Dutch?
I've always been Dutch. And yet, yeah. You know, I was very much trying to be a good girl. And now I'm just me.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's universal though, because I, you know.
No, I think you're right.
I think it's men and women, because I think it's a different way.
Well, let's look at our own
manifestation, but.
Well, let's look at our own mothers.
Oh God, really?
Just for a moment, because I mean, I think that your mother is really, has got to that stage in life where she does not give.
No, she'll say whatever. Like totally.
She's probably been a bit like that. My mother now, I mean, dementia has gripped her, but to some extent, but she's always been someone who wants to please.
Yeah.
And now she has the freedom
yeah.
to say what she really thinks. And it's been really fun to hear it because, you know, it's been hidden away for a long time.
Well, I've got a funny story. My mum was in hospital and they gave her a sort of an anti-sickness drug. And there's a small portion of people who react badly to this anti-sickness drug. And she was one of them. And it makes them very honest. And so my sister and myself went to visit her. Well, just after she'd had this drug, and she went, you are the bane of my life. Like being really mean to me. My sister and I were just giggling because it was very funny. It was very, I mean, she wasn't nasty with it, but it was almost like going off and living in other countries. And
yeah, she almost became, it sounds like she became possessed.
Almost, yeah.
But yeah,
anyway, yeah.
The true serum.
So oh, the true person comes out, yeah.
That's fascinating. In terms of your working routine, in terms of your writing, I mean, you're clearly very busy. You've got teenage boys as well, which, you know.
Oh, I know what that's like, yeah.
Has its own demands, not least keeping the fridge full. But what's your routine like? Do you make time, I'm guessing from what you've been saying about, you know, being a control freak, you set yourself a goal and you go and achieve it.
Yes, I'm very professional that way. No, not really. So I'm in the very fortunate position that I work as a freelancer and I do not need to work all the time because of the type of work I do. I earn a reasonable living. And this is another one of the things that you say to aspiring writers, you know, it's going to take some time and a lot of luck to be able to make this your full-time career. But I love what I do and I wouldn't want to give it up either. So what happens is that I write books when I'm not working. Mm. So I will have periods where I'm not working. And then, you know, I try to not just lie in my bed all day and actually get up and do some work. So I then, you know, write all day. I'm very slow, but I'm very meticulous. So I edit as I go, which means that if I've done 1,200 words in a day, they don't really need an awful lot more after. And because I'm an uber plotter, I know everything that happens in advance, down to the smallest detail. I also don't have huge amounts of structural edits. So by the time the book's done, then, you know, it needs work. Of course, it needs work, but it's more like the varnish and the added things and the added depth and stuff. But, you know, there's not going to be any plot holes because I'm a very logical person.
Yes. I mean, that is a good point about being a plotter, isn't it? I mean, there are people who do it the other way, where they just sit down and they start writing. They don't know where it's going and they say, the story takes me this way and takes me that way. But there is a big but, isn't it? That then you have to spend a lot of time.
Yeah, but this is difficult for me because I'm the completely opposite, and it would be anathema for me to sit down and plotting and indeed any form of planning, which my job did involve.
Yeti likes a tidy dishwasher.
I like a tidy dishwasher, yeah. But that's about as organized as I get. I mean, it really, yeah, I really cannot sit in front of a spreadsheet or anything like that. It just isn't going to happen for me.
I think people sort of look at it as being just planning, and then once you know what happens, it's not interesting anymore. And I disagree, because ultimately my work is about problem solving. It's my favorite thing to do. You have a problem, come to me. I think my LinkedIn bio even says, I've never met a complex problem I didn't like. You know, it's what I do and I love it. And I view this as problem solving. So the planning is having the structure, the skeleton of a story, and to make that work. Like, how do I make a story with a nice twist and a this and a that work? Mm-hmm. And that's a problem to solve. And then the next problem when you are writing the words is actually, I have my outline, which is 13,000 words, so about a sixth of a book. And it says exactly what needs to happen in this chapter. But then the problem is, how do you get that to flow naturally in those 2,000, 1,500, whatever words, in a way that makes sense, in a way that the people would actually react? And so it's getting from point A at the start of the chapter to point B at the end of the chapter. And the trajectory that takes is also problem solving. And so sure. There's a second level of enjoyment there.
Yeah, no, that's right. I mean, you know, I totally agree with you. You know, when you have got, even if you know what the outcome is at the end of that, and you're the point where you want to finish, the joy is that sense of, I mean, I love that period when I'm writing a chapter and there's a flow, but your mind, subconscious, takes over and solves those problems for you. It is a wonderful feeling. There's nothing better, I think, in the world, really, than that sense. But I don't think I could ever start, you know, I never would have the discipline, to be perfectly honest, to be able to map out exactly how it's going to be.
You also, it's impatience as well, I think.
Oh yeah,
you just want to do it. You just want to get on with it. Mm. The same with any project that we do. Well, I say to you,
really making our listeners, our authors are listening to this.
I'll say to you, look, let's just sit and think about it for a minute before you go off and do it.
True. True.
But I think, you know, somewhere in the middle is always a good place to be.
Well, I've always been one of the great sort of plate spinners of the world, in terms of, you know, and that's when things were at their most fluid and most in the moment at work in the BBC as a journalist, that's when I was at my best. Where there was no, you know, you could, and that's in itself has value, but greater value was always placed in an environment and an organization like that on somebody who could come up with the lovely spreadsheet of how this is going to unfold, you know, which in many ways it often does. But at the same time, if you haven't got somebody who can think on their feet, then you're in trouble.
That's what I say. You need both, don't you?
Well, especially if you're working in sport or news, because, you know, you can't tell me it's, you know, exactly what's going to happen.
Unpredictable.
Absolutely.
Yeah, exactly,
absolutely. Yeah. We're approaching that moment.
Oh, are we?
Yeah.
Oh.
We are. the moment where no amount of planning, no amount of...
You can't plan for this.
No. There is no...
No, this stresses me out, right?
Right. This is it. There's no...
And I don't plan that much either. I thought of it while I walked from there, from the kitchen to the...
I have no control over what is about to come out of Rebecca's mouth. So let us... I'll give it the build-up and then we will hit the random question. Here we go.
Rebecca's random question.
Well, ironically, this is a bit quite related to what we've been talking about sort of being a woman and being busy and trying to be perfect. And I was in the kitchen just now working and I thought, and it's a bad thing to say, but I'd love to get an illness now so I could lie in bed for a bit. But nobody likes being ill, do they? They don't like the symptoms you get. So I thought if I could create an illness which meant you didn't have to work but was actually quite pleasant, what symptoms would I have? For me, it would be something like compulsive need to read books, inability to cook meals for people so I could lie in bed and read. So my question to you is, if you were to invent a virus, what would be the good symptoms that your virus could have?
Wow.
I think the virus that I would want is immobile muscle toning. I think it would, the virus would chew through your muscles and sort of strengthen the you know, filaments in your muscles while you're lying in bed. And the minute you move, it stops. And so really you should stay in bed and have your muscles strengthened by this virus until such time that you think enough is enough and you don't want to turn into Arnold Schwarzenegger. And then you get back up and cook dinner.
That is.
I
think that's marvelous.
Yeah. Considering you came up with that on the spot as well. Like, you know, sounds like you thought about it.
I'd like a virus that gave me guitarist calluses on my left hand. So that I could play the, you know, because I'm working on it. I am working. Here we go. Here comes the guitar. But it's, you know, as Rebecca was saying, I want instant gratification and results. And learning the guitar is anything but.
So your virus would give you instant guitar skills.
Well, no, it would give me the...
Just the hard fingers.
Yeah. Alternatively, you know, if they could be a little longer, because as you can see... Helene, these are rather sausagey fingers, rather short, and so the guitar really isn't my instrument, but I'm determined to master it.
Whereas I have much longer sort of good fingers for guitar, but I can only play Smelly Cat.
We all love Smelly Cat.
So Helene, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you. Where can people find you online and follow your author career?
I'm most active on Twitter, I would say. So if you want to engage, then it's HKist on Twitter, although it's a bit of a dying platform at the moment. So we'll see what happens to it. But that's if you want me to engage, absolutely, that's the place to be. I am on Facebook also, but just not very disciplined at that. You can buy all three of my books on the Big Zone and any other retailer. And they are in stock in Scottish Waterstones, or the What I Hid From You is as well. And and I have a website, helenekist.com, where you can send me a message if you want, and just look at pictures that I paid money to have made of me.
I love that. What have you got coming next? Have you got any books in the pipeline?
I do. It's a bit of a departure. It's a locked room mystery. But in it is very contemporary, but golden era like in its impossible crimes. So people are stuck in the residence gym of a smart apartment building, top floor, and people start dropping like flies, and you don't know how, you don't know why, and you don't know who.
Wow. That sounds
intriguing.
Fantastic.
I like locked room stories. So.
You do. Yeah. You do. Right.
I'll lock you in a room. Make a story about it.
Absolutely. Lock me in my studio. It's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us, Helene.
Thank you, and have a lovely day.
Our thanks to Helene Kist for joining us on the Hopcast Book Show. And she did really well with the random question. Really quick answer.
I know. I didn't expect that at all, but she did really well.
Terrific. And our guest next week. Is.
Our guest next week is Amir Anwar,
who is a previous winner of the CWA Debut Dagger.
Yes, so it's quite exciting.
It is very exciting, yeah. Based in London, Amir Anwar is joining us on the Hopcast next week. So, as you'd have gathered from our Archers segment at the beginning of the show, and the reason we did that was because we took inspiration. We were in the mailbox in Birmingham this week, en route to looking at a Grace and Perry exhibition in Birmingham. But the mailbox is the home of BBC Birmingham, and it is where they make The Archers.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's based in Birmingham, and so we thought we would pay our own little homage to the way that The Archers is put together. And if you're very lucky, you might just hear one or two of us, perhaps, making an attempt at The Archers theme tune a little later.
You will hear that, because I'm determined.
In fact, yes, you probably heard it at the beginning. I haven't decided where it's going to sit in the show, but we will decide. The big decision this week is whether we go to London Book Fair. And realistically, as we're meeting one of our authors on Wednesday, our only day to go is Tuesday this week. And I'm...
And it probably will be just one of us because of family commitments.
Well, that is a big factor. But the other factor is, as we said in previous episodes, is just how tough an environment it is. And everyone's time pressured at London Book Fair. To actually get much out of it is going to be a challenge, to be honest.
So it is. We're sitting on the fence at the moment about it. We really don't know whether it's worth.
Yeah, there's plenty of other
time
things to be getting on with. To be honest. Anyway, no, I mean at the moment I'm leaning not going because you know any trip to London, day trip, squeezing all of that in, arriving back home, I just find it knackering. Actually, it knocks me out for the chunk of the week that follows. So we'll see. I'm very delighted to say that finally I have finished recording the Legionary series by Gordon Doherty, or at least the five books I was commissioned to do of the eight. So that's eight with my narration credits on it. I finished it a couple of days ago, and I feel really fantastic about that because it has been an epic project of about 3 months' work.
Yeah, it's consumed your life since just after Christmas.
Yeah, and it's been I've learned a lot from it. I've written a blog. If you go to adrianhobartnarration.com, another of our websites, you will find my blog. And it is all about what I've learned from doing such a big project and the things that I have done differently from previous recordings.
And it features a lovely picture of the Hobart cottage.
It does. It does. And you are so mega busy at the minute.
Yes, I've just finished one big editing project for another publisher, which I thoroughly enjoyed. So I'm in that happy space before I embark on the next lot of work. And I've been cleaning.
You have? That, in a departure, Rebecca's been cleaning. No, we haven't had the boys here this week. And we did say to ourselves, we'll get the house in order. And we haven't really. But then, you know. You know, best, but you know, it's other things get in the way, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, it's a surface clean, but it needed doing and it's done.
Yes,
it looks a bit better.
It does look a bit better. Yeah,
so I'm going to dive into the work tomorrow.
Yeah, and I have written myself a very long project list of all the things that I want to get on top of that perhaps have been sidelined a little by the narration projects. But it's been, as I say, an honor to do those books for WF Howes Limited, who will be at London Book Fair. And maybe if I do go, then I'll go and have a chat with them.
Say hi.
And say hi. Hi, I'm the author. I'm the narrator of five of your books out of the 2,000 you released this year.
You know. And they'll say, oh, yeah, we know you.
Yeah, they're not going to say that.
You're the voice of Pavo.
If you go on their, yeah, if you go on their website, you know, they sort of talk about the narrators they use, like David Tennant and Judy Dench and Ian McKellen. And funnily enough, I don't actually feature in that section.
Well, humph.
Yeah, it's only a matter of time. It really is. It really is. So thank you for joining us on the Hobcast Book Show. Amer Amnoir is our guest next week, and we look forward to speaking to you then. Don't forget to go to our websites, plural, adrianhobartnarration.com.
Could be here a while.
For your narration projects. archpublishing.net for our publishing services. And we had quite a lot of interest this week, which is very gratifying. And, of course, www.hobeck.net for details of all of our authors, including our new one, Hilly Barmby, who we'll be publishing
in the autumn.
In the autumn, yeah. Yes, that's right.
And we have a mutual friend with Hilly, don't we? Which was a bit of a surprise.
It was a big surprise. Absolutely, 100%. Yeah, friends from Brighton. So that was exciting. And yeah, there you can find all the details of what we get up to. And we look forward to seeing you at www.hobeck.net. But for myself, Adrian Hobart.
And myself, Clary Grundy. I mean, Rebecca Collins.
We'd like to thank you for joining us. And we wish you a wonderful and...
creative...
week. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Hobcast from Hobeck Books with Adrian Hobart and Rebecca Collins. You can find the show notes at our website, www.hobeck.net. You can also use the exclusive Hobcast discount code for any of the products at our Hobeck online store. Just enter the code HOBCAST20 for a 20% discount. Don't forget to subscribe to the Hobcast and feel free to contact us with any feedback. Until next time, remember our motto, Trad Values, Indie Spirit.